Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Hiring can be a slow process. Cafe Altura's COO, Dylan Miskowitz, needed to hire a director of coffee for his organic coffee company, but he was having trouble finding qualified applicants. So he switched to ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its technology identifies people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job, so you get qualified candidates fast. Dylan posted his job on ZipRecruiter and said he was impressed by how quickly he had great candidates apply. He also used ZipRecruiter's candidate rating feature to filter his applicants so he could focus on the most relevant ones. And that's how Dylan found his new director of coffee in just a few days. With results like that, it's no wonder 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. See why ZipRecruiter is effective for businesses of all sizes. Try ZipRecruiter for free at our web address, ZipRecruiter.com/murder. That's ZipRecruiter.com/MURDER. ZipRecruiter.com/murder. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Norco 80 tells the story of how 5 heavily armed young men, led by an apocalyptic born-again Christian, attempted a bank robbery that turned into one of the most violent criminal events in U.S. history, forever changing the face of American law enforcement. Part action thriller and part courtroom drama, Norco 80 transports the reader back to the Southern California of the 70s, an era of predatory evangelical gurus, doomsday predictions, megachurches, and soaring crime rates, with the threat of nuclear obliteration looming over it all. In this riveting true story, a group of landscapers transformed into a murderous gang of bank robbers armed to the teeth with military-grade weapons. Their desperate getaway turned the surrounding towns into war zones. When it was over, 3 were dead and close to 20 wounded. A police helicopter was forced down from the sky, and 32 police vehicles were destroyed by thousands of rounds of ammo. The resulting trial shook the community to the core, raising many issues that continue to plague society today, from the epidemic of post-traumatic stress disorder within law enforcement to religious extremism and the militarization of local police forces. The book that we're featuring this evening is Norco 80, the true story of the most spectacular bank robbery in American history, with my special guest, journalist and author, Peter Houlihan. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Peter Houlihan.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you very much. This is one incredibly exciting book, I have to say. Let's start right off from the beginning, as we described in the introduction, or I did. Let's talk about what somebody in California, what these two people, what many people saw, besides George Wayne Smith and Christopher Harvin, but what other people saw, but people born in the 50s, as you write, tell us about the violent crime rates. Take us back to Southern California of the 1970s and up to this date in 1980. What did these people see?
Sure. Both the time and the era in which this, or the time and the place in which this happened, are had an influence on bringing this about, this bank robbery. The bank robbers are all from Orange County, California, a suburb of Los Angeles, and they came of age in the 1970s. And for George Wayne Smith, there were a number of things that influenced him and kind of propelled him towards this bank robbery. One was the very aggressively evangelical born-again Christian movement that began in Orange County, California in the 70s and then swept throughout the country. It was known as the Jesus Movement, and it was these were youth ministries that were revolved around the Book of Revelation and end times theology. And at an early age, George became involved in Calvary Chapel. And at that time, Calvary was really based on the rapture and the second coming. So George, at an early age, believed that the apocalypse and the cataclysmic events and the collapse of society that would lead up to it was imminent. And Calvary Chapel really pressed the idea that the rapture could come at any moment. And that was certainly for George to have been in Orange County as a young man in the 1970s was really brought that about. The other was that if you're in that front mind frame, and then you're on the lookout for current events that you can match up with Revelation prophecy.
Sure.
Southern California of the 1970s and most everywhere in the 1970s was a place you sure could find it. There were a lot of doomsday scenarios that were bandied around in the 70s, whether it be asteroid strikes or massive earthquakes or population bombs. And also there were, as you say, crime rates that would be almost unimaginable today. And a lot of the ideologies of the 1960s really turned ugly in the 70s. Recreational drug use became drug abuse. Free love became unwanted pregnancies. There was some really startling events like the Jonestown
right.
mass suicide, the Symbionese Liberation Army. There was a lot of revolutionary groups, especially in the early 70s, that were bombing things and trying to bring down society. So when George looked out at the world, he could see a lot of events in the United States that looked like social collapse, Babylonian-style social breakdown, and also internationally. At the end of the 70s and into the early 80s, there was the Iran hostage situation. There was war in the Middle East. And as you say, the existential threat hanging over all of it is really nuclear war. And right out of high school, George Wayne Smith went into the Army, and he was trained as an artilleryman and stationed in Germany, and he was trained on tactical battlefield nuclear weapons. And that was what really made the 1970s dangerous, especially for the possibility of nuclear war, was this proliferation of battlefield nuclear weapons. Once you use one of those, it's not hard to imagine escalating into the intercontinental ballistics missiles that would bring along obliteration. So when George looked out at the world, a lot of things matched up. And as in terms of how it all might end, nuclear war was something that was not hard for him to imagine and, frankly, not hard for others to imagine. And I'll just briefly talk about George's – George was the one who really planned – this bank robbery and recruited the others. He had a roommate. They owned a house together, Christopher Harvin. And Christopher Harvin was a bit of a survivalist, and his idea of how the end might come for the collapse of social order and lawlessness was those doomsday scenarios I had mentioned earlier, but of a kind of natural disaster or man-made rather than something that would come from God. And also included nuclear war, but asteroid strikes and particularly and things like that, population bombs. But really, he believed in something called the Jupiter Effect, and the Jupiter Effect was a book that was about a alignment of planets that was going to come in 1982. It did come, in which the planets would be aligned all on the opposite side of the sun, and they would affect gravitational pulls. It would trigger volcanoes, earthquakes, and things like that. And both George and Chris had their dates, and George's was the apocalypse or the rapture would come before the end of 1980, and for Chris, as I say, it was looming ahead just a year and a half ahead. So sorry, that's a rather long answer, but it's certainly all those different factors fed into George Wayne Smith and Christopher Harvin kind of looking that they needed to prepare for lawlessness, social breakdown, in which only the well-armed and well-funded and well-prepared would survive.
You talk about the difference in the characters between Chris Harvin and George Smith, certainly in high school and then in the military. Tell us about that before you talk about the situation that they found themselves. Both had met at the landscaping gig that they had, but now what was their current situation? So tell us about that.
Yeah, there were other factors that kind of triggered them to take this action at the time. They really were two different personalities, and they had both suffered downturns in personal fortune leading up to this. They had both lost their jobs as landscapers for the city parks department. They had breakups in their marriage. They were running out of money. George had this kind of a psychological makeup that may have destined him to be involved in some sort of event in which people would hurt or die. And that was, he had this grandiosity about him, this idea that what he wanted and what he needed was more important than everyone else. He wasn't a guy who set out to kill people. In fact, George had kind of channeled this grandiosity and this idea that he could save everybody around him for the good up until then. Everyone around him would say that he's a great guy. I mean, and he was. I mean, up until then, he's a guy to help you out, do anything, lend you money, save your soul. He was pretty aggressively evangelical himself. And so when he looked at his life and saw what you and I might think of as a temporary downturn in fortune, he looked at as a absolute disaster. It was a cognitive dissonance between the person he thought he was destined always to become, the great person, and a guy who was pretty much down on his luck, had lost his family, was about to lose his home, and everything else. And these guys are in their, they're 27 and 28 years old, so that's their age when they start to take this on and when they commit this crime. Chris Harvin's just kind of a troublemaker. You know, he's a guy, kid who'd do anything on a dare. He was always getting in trouble at school, nothing horrendously malicious, nothing violent. Neither of them had any criminal record. Those two, and then they had this downturn in fortune, and in their personal lives, combined with this idea that you could have a cataclysmic events looming in the future, and they thought they needed some money to address that and prepare themselves.
Now you talk about their compound at Mira Loma. Tell us the proximity to Los Angeles. But also tell us about the nature of this little community, and the distance between Norco and other communities. Tell us where it's situated, and tell us a little bit about this Mira Loma and my idea that it's somewhat of a compound in their mind.
Yeah, it's a modest compound. The robbery itself took place in Riverside County, California, and eventually went into the pursuit went into San Bernardino County. This is an area known as the Inland Empire. It's roughly 40 miles east of Los Angeles, still part of the L.A. metro area. Really gritty, blue-collar area. A lot of warehouses. There's a steel mill out there, the Kaiser Steel Mill. Mira Loma is semi-rural, a gritty neighborhood of it was unincorporated area, so that the zoning laws weren't great. Some ramshackle houses out there, but mostly a relatively quiet, suburban neighborhood. Again, you call it probably lower working class, blue collar. And they had bought a house there and together. And it was a modest stucco ranch with a small compound, because it was really just a little over a quarter acre. And but as they prepared, not just for the bank robbery, but again to put them in a position to survive the apocalypse, they began to put barbed wire up around the perimeter walls of their backyard and put nailing carpet tacks. So if anybody tried to come over that perimeter, they'd tear their hands up. And they built, they dug a pit and a tunnel that went from their backyard underneath their garage so they could either escape the house or use it as a bunker. And they also, they were guys who liked guns, but they really began to ramp up and kind of put together an arsenal at that point.
So they were on, as you write, they're in desperate need of money. But Chris and George, even though they're really good friends and they have a lot of things in common and they have this shared apocalyptic future belief, tell us about George's initial plan and introduce Russell Harvin and Manny Delgado. Who are these people and where did they come from? Who brings in who?
Certainly. George Wayne Smith first had an idea that he was going to rob a Denny's restaurant. And Chris said, well, if you're going to, Chris Harvin said, well, if you're going to rob anything, you might as well rob a bank. And then George began to start to plan that. And he got more and more serious, the more and more desperate he became. And Chris really was kind of reluctant about it. But George is a very persuasive, a very articulate guy. And so he began to really pressure Chris to do this, to rob a bank. And I mentioned George's grandiosity. Well, that extended to his plan to rob the bank. Chris also mentioned that, you know, he wasn't going to do it unless they were well armed when they went in. But George put together a rather elaborate plan in which he would address every contingency, and that included being armed to the teeth with civilian versions of military-grade weapons. These are, AR-15s, Heckler, HK-91s, HK-93s. These are .223 caliber weapons, and George was packing a .308, which is an absolute cannon, and thousands of rounds of ammunition, high-powered, high-capacity magazines, 40-round magazines that they taped together jungle style. So there was three of them taped together. You could pop out, flip over, put it back in. So they started to put together this grand plan. But, you know, you get a grandiose plan like this, an elaborate plan, it also almost guarantees that something will go wrong. And it did. They needed they decided they needed five people to pull this bank robbery off. And so Chris Harvin recruited his younger brother, Russell Harvin. And Russell was just he's going nowhere in his life. He was diabetic, but he was just kind of hanging out at home, working odd jobs, smoking a lot of weed. And when his brother asked him if he wanted to do it or told him he should do it, Russ just kind of went along with it. Russ didn't really think things through. Russell's about 26 years old at the time, 27 years old at the time. George also recruits Manny Delgado. Manny Delgado was only 21 years old, and they knew each other from, again, working as landscapers at the Parks Department. And then Manny recruited his little brother, 17-year-old Billy Delgado, to be the getaway driver. And Manny and Billy were from very different backgrounds. They were really from the barrio in Orange County, from really tough neighborhoods. And they all had their kind of different reasons for wanting to do it. Manny had one child and another one on the way. His wife was 9 months pregnant. He felt he needed money. Billy had kind of a hopelessness about him. He had rheumatoid arthritis and believed that he wouldn't be able to walk past the age of 25. And Russell Harvin somehow got it in his head that his diabetes would doom him to death before the age of 35. So they all kind of felt like they had nothing to lose and a kind of a bit of a desperation about him.
It's also, I know we mentioned it, but it's important to know for our audience how much rejection these people had from women that had their children in their lives, three out of the four that we just mentioned. Talk about that a little bit, because I think it's really important.
Yeah, they, George's, all of them married very young, but George married at age 18, right? Out of high school, and that marriage quickly collapsed when he went off to Germany. He was then married again to a woman who was 10 years older than him, and when they had a child, really their marriage started to fall apart. George was still concentrating on stockpiling weapons and talking about the end of the world, and his wife was trying to raise a baby. And so that marriage also fell apart just months before the bank robbery. And again, George had this view of himself as he was going to save everyone around him, that he was a really good and responsible guy, and up until then he was, and couldn't understand why this had happened. Christopher Harvin's married at age 18, and by age 27 he was his marriage was falling apart. He was not being able to see his kid as much as he wanted to. Russell Harvin married at age 18, and that wife ran off with another woman several years later. You know, she was actually married to another man and had another a child. And but Russ still wore their wedding ring.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they were these guys were definitely kind of brokenhearted, and a lot of other bad things happening in their lives.
You write about the incredible scene in this little place at a place called Dave's, where they get their weaponry. I know you mentioned some of the incredible weapons that they had. That it's beyond hunting and beyond anything, and very, very military type weaponry. But you talk about Dave and this going back to Dave. So I think it's very incredible cinematic scene in here, but tell us about them going to get weapons, and what is their idea about spending the last bit of their money to get these weapons?
Yeah, that's kind of one of the contradictions, is that they did take the last few $1,000s they had and started to ramp up. As I say, they'd always had, you know, handguns around and nothing crazy, you know, just kind of people who were, they used to take them up hunting and things like that. You know, George had a carbine, same sort of, single shot, but the weapons that they began to buy as they moved closer to this were the, again, the military grade weapons, civilian version, meaning they're semi-automatic rather than fully automatic. But they would just, all of these weapons were legally purchased. They were not nearly as prevalent back then as they are now, these semi-automatic, what's commonly referred to as assault rifles. And they were around. They were legal, but they weren't. But they were not nearly as prevalent. And Dave's gun shop was just one of the places they purchased it. And they would go to different gun stores. But in the course of a week, George Smith walked into Dave's. I think he went three times and purchased two semi-automatic weapons, a 223, an AR-15, and a Heckler & Koch HK-91, which, as I say, is a 308. And a 308 is a round that's three times as big as a 223. Not an animal in the world that can't be brought down with one single shot from a 308 from a half mile away. And, the guy at Dave's was starting to wonder kind of what was going on, and he joked to a semi-joked to George Smith, gee, what do you need all these for? Are you going to start a war or rob a bank? And George just laughed.
Right. Now, part of the plan, tell us about the plan itself, what George had come up with and what they had all agreed to, and then what did they do in preparation? You talk about the anarchist cookbook that they had access to.
Yeah, the other part of their arsenal, in addition to each, all five of them carrying one of these high-powered semi-automatic rifles and thousands of rounds of ammunition, is they used the Anarchist Cookbook to make homemade fragmentation grenades. These are made out of beer cans with an incendiary device in the middle, a detonation device in the middle, and then shrapnel around them, and they tape them up in electrical tape. Duct tape, and they had fashioned these with some of them on dowels so that you could launch them out of the barrel of a shotgun up to 100 yards. So you light the fuse and you can launch it out of a shotgun, or you can just, you know, toss them. They had a couple dozen of these. They had Molotov cocktails, wine bottles filled with leaded gasoline. So once they had all these weapons, and again, all of them had one of these rifles on them. All of them had one or more handguns on them. And the plan was this, and this is indeed what they executed the day of the bank robbery, which was Friday, May 9th, 1980. In the morning, three of them, the Delgado brothers and Russell Harvin, went to a shopping mall 20 miles away, the Brea Mall, and they stole a van at gunpoint, and they taped up the owner, Gary Hakala, and put him in the back of the van so he could not report it stolen. They then, Chris and George, and met up with them, and they still had Gary Hakala taped up in the back, and they went and put a diversion bomb underneath a gas main a mile away. And this was six beer bottles filled with gasoline with a detonation device in it, and they put that underneath a gas main at a behind a strip mall, and it did indeed go off, but it did not ignite the gas main. A passerby put it out with a fire extinguisher. But the plan was that obviously that once that went off in this massive explosion, every first responder, including every cop, would be on their way to that, and then they would hit the bank. And the bank that George eventually chose was the Security Pacific Bank in Norco, California, which borders Mira Loma. Again, we're talking just about the center of Riverside County or near Riverside City. George chose his own bank. So the bank that they robbed was George's bank. And they put on ski masks, military ponchos, and they waited for the diversion bomb to go off, expecting to see all the first responders head down Hamner Avenue towards there. And when that didn't happen, they waited till about 3:30 in the afternoon, and then they decided to go ahead and hit the bank anyways.
Let's talk about, again, an incredibly movie-esque scene in here where we have a Deputy Chuck Hill and Andy Delgado. And you provide the backgrounds for this, and such vivid characters emerge in this story, and a lot of vivid characters emerge. Law enforcement and on the other side, but much more in law enforcement, rich characters. Let's talk about these two guys and why they were right there across from the bank, doing what? Tell us about this and the reaction from these bank robbers.
Sure. And the third Riverside County Sheriff's deputy patrolling Norco that day was Glenn Belaski, and he's the first
right.
one to encounter them. So it's Andy Delgado, Chuck Hill, and Glenn Belaski. And yeah, I do. You know, one of the things that really interests me in this story, and I do take a lot of time to paint the picture, is the backgrounds of these various law enforcement officers who became involved in this and kind of the impact it had afterwards. But, you know, the bank robbery itself, and this is George, Russ, Chris, and Manny Delgado crashing into this bank in ski masks and camouflage, and Billy Delgado is the getaway driver sitting outside in this van. That actually, it was a lot of drama that goes on in that bank, as goes on with pretty much any takeover robbery where they put everybody down on the floor. But, you know, there's a lot of drama that unfolded inside there. But for the most part, they got in that bank and they got out in 2.5 minutes. However, when they were going in the bank in their camouflage and their ski masks and rifles, they were spotted by a bank teller at a bank across the street. And it is that bank teller who called the Riverside County Sheriff's to report a robbery at the bank across the street. it took about 2 minutes before the dispatcher sent out the 211 robbery in progress tone for the Security Pacific Bank, 4th and Hamner in Norco. And at that time, Deputy Glenn Belaski just happened to be sitting at that intersection looking straight at that bank. So if you talk about some bad luck mixed in with some rather unfortunate planning, that's where it came in, was the fact that Glenn Belaski was right outside that bank. So Glenn Belaski, you can hear him on the radio traffic. He reports himself on scene in less than 2 seconds after that dispatch. This is right as the bank robbers are coming out of the bank. Deputy Glenn Belaski begins to take fire almost immediately. As he takes the turn, just to cruise into the bank and to see what's going on. And Belaski had so little time to really think through what he was getting himself into that he did not process that this was a 211 in progress as opposed to a 211 silent. And most silent alarms are, alarms are false alarms. 9 out of 10 of them are, but this was a confirmed robbery in progress, and that's when Glenn Belaski came head to head with these bank robbers.
You talk about including this. I know this is a bit of a detour here for a second, but you talk about the prevalence of armed robbery, bank robbery in Los Angeles, how often that actually happened, and also, tell us first about that.
Sure.
How commonplace is this?
Yeah. Los Angeles for decades had been the what the FBI called the bank robbery capital of the world. And one out of every four bank robberies in the United States takes place within the jurisdiction of the Los Angeles field office of the FBI. and the reason is mostly freeways. You know, you can rob a bank and you can jump on a freeway, and in 5 minutes you could be 5 miles away and cruising the side streets of a whole different police jurisdiction. The golden rule of robbing banks in Los Angeles is rob a bank near a freeway. And again, George decided to rob his own bank, and it was 7 miles away from the nearest freeway. But 1980 was really the sheer number of bank robberies. So Los Angeles had already established itself as the bank robbery capital of the world, but the sheer number of bank robberies was beginning to skyrocket, and most of that was because of drug abuse and the cocaine era. When people got addicted, they needed money to feed that habit, and robbing a bank in Los Angeles was not all that difficult. The vast majority are one-on-one robberies. That's one bank robber going to one teller, telling them, you know, slipping them a note that says, give me all your money, and then leaving the bank with $2,000, $3,000, something like that. clearly, George and Chris were not driven by addiction, and this was a completely different sort of robbery. This is a takeover robbery, and takeover robberies have the potential for danger and casualties, and they're the robberies that really the FBI lose sleep over, are these takeover robberies.
I'm glad you brought up the freeway, the reason for all the bank robberies in Los Angeles, and also what their idea was. But because George picked his own bank, in terms of the idea that it had easy access to a getaway, you talk about that assessment of Norco itself. Also, when that silent alarm went off, And the police were alerted, there was a misdirect as well that just added to this incredible inadvertent diversion, even more so than the diversion they had originally planned.
There was some bad luck for the bank as well. And again, just to put the industry of banking in perspective, in 1980, this is a Friday afternoon and it's payday. And so back in those days, people did not use credit cards for nearly as much, and there really were ATMs were pretty much non-existent, and people would go in and they'd generally cash half their paycheck and walk out with cash on it. So banks carried a lot of cash, but as the day went on, the bank was also emptying itself out of cash, and they robbed this bank at 3:30 in the afternoon. The bank itself did not even have cameras in it. Most did, but this branch did not have any security cameras in it. One teller did manage to trigger the silent alarm, but the bank had been wired incorrectly, and that alarm went to the Corona Police Department. That's the neighboring town. The Corona Police Department dispatched a robbery in progress to the Corona branch of the Security Pacific Bank. So there was a certainly a delay there, and if it had not been for that bank teller across the street who had seen them go in and called the Riverside sheriffs and gave them the correct location, none of what followed may have happened at all, and that might have been for the better for all involved as well. That first alarm went to the wrong city.
Yeah, you talk about Belosky and then Gary Keeter knowing that Belosky was in trouble. But part of this is also the technology at the time in terms of radios and also jurisdictions, different counties. Tell us about that situation in terms of technologically being able to communicate with each other.
Yeah, dispatcher Gary Keeter is kind of an interesting story. He was actually a patrolman who'd injured his knee and was so assigned behind the dispatch mic. And he is he did an absolutely incredible job during this running gun battle that went on for an hour. Just had so many moving parts, and you hear his voice on the radio traffic. He is calm and cool and filtering through so much information. But here's one of the problems that really plagued law enforcement at the time and still does to a certain extent. But this pursuit, it started with a pitched firefight in front of the bank between three sheriff's deputies and five bank robbers, in which people were wounded and one bank robber killed, and then became a running gun battle through the suburban streets of Riverside County onto a major highway that went into San Bernardino County and then up into the mountains. So the law enforcement agencies involved heavily were the Riverside County Sheriffs, San Bernardino County Sheriffs, and the California Highway Patrol, not to mention some other city agencies that came in and were involved. And none of these guys could talk to each other, the different agencies. There's an interagency system called CLAMARS, which was just beginning to be implemented, and there was only one in which you could go to a different frequency and all talk to each other, but that did not really come into play until later on, and even in a very limited sense. Some patrol units had scanners, so they could pick up different frequencies, but they could not talk to those other agencies. So when this became a pursuit with up to 30, sometimes 40 law enforcement vehicles involved, these guys could not talk to each other, nor could some of them talk to the helicopter above, which was pursuing the bank robbers, and that would prove to be fatal later on in at the end of the pursuit. That inability for the lead patrol unit to be able to talk directly to that helicopter and receive reports from that helicopter as to where the truck was with the bank robbers in front of it.
Before we talk about this incredible pursuit, and before that, the complete change of direction for these bank robbers, they had, with the diversion, the idea that they would have cold cars, they switch license plates, so that they'd be able to go into another vehicle after they stole this first vehicle. But that doesn't happen, and they can't go back to Mira Loma, so this pursuit changes, and no one knows, and the police certainly can't predict much of a direction, but they have their ideas, and it's interesting, all these sheriffs, again, and deputies, pardon me, that are involved in this pursuit. Let's first talk about how outgunned the police were at that time, because that's a big contributing factor to not only Jim Evans' death, but this entire thing that could have turned much, much worse.
Yeah, certainly. At that time, the sheriff's deputies were still guarding the Wild West with the same weapons they had for 100 years, and that's a six-shooter and a Winchester shotgun. And as you can see, that was no match for the weaponry that they were about to encounter. And confrontation between law enforcement and the bank robbers, as I noted, started immediately in front of the bank when Glenn Belosky came head-to-head with them. And then soon Chuck Hill and Andy Delgado, the other two deputies who were patrolling Norco, came on scene. And there was a pitched firefight in a crowded Southern California intersection at 3:30 in the afternoon on a Friday. And there were over 500 rounds fired. Belosky's vehicle was hit 46 times. Belosky was wounded by bullet fragments or flying glass. in five different places, including a shot to the elbow that severed an artery. But Belaski did manage to get off four shotgun rounds, and Andy Delgado managed to discharge his shotgun with 10 rounds, and they did inflict some damage. The getaway driver, Billy Delgado, was shot in the back of the head with a shotgun pellet that paralyzed him, and the van veered off course and crashed into a fence. So the police were effective with what they had, but once the pursuit got going after that, they really didn't stand a chance, because when Billy Delgado was killed, the van kind of rolled off to the side, and they couldn't get Billy out of the seat, so they abandoned the van and spread out into the intersection. They brought their they left their $20,000 that they'd gotten from the bank robbery, which was a terrible take, and and they offloaded their duffel bags full of bombs and ammunition, and brought their rifles with them, and began to fan out into this intersection while laying down heavy fire the entire time on the three deputies there, and as I say, significantly wounding Belaski. But in general, the police were completely outgunned, especially because the bank robbers then commandeered a Ford F-250 pickup truck that was used that had been modified for as a service vehicle, a heavy equipment maintenance truck. So it had they'd fabricated a cabinets on the sides of it, and they were filled with equipment and tools, and then they'd mounted acetylene and oxygen tanks on the back against the cab, those big tall tanks, and there's nothing the police were shooting that would ever penetrate those. So this was, you had Russ Harvin and George Smith in the back. Both had been wounded. George had been wounded pretty significantly. You had Manny Delgado sitting out the passenger window. He literally had his torso completely out the passenger window, and Chris Harvin driving, and all of the three guys had these semi-automatic high-powered rifles. So for all intents and purposes, this was like a military vehicle in terms of its armor and as well as its firepower.
Chris Harvin has taken over from Billy Delgado, the driver that was shot in the back of the head. So what do they decide to do, knowing this area, but what is the decision that they do that police couldn't possibly predict where to go with this pursuit? And how is that an advantage to them?
Certainly. So to set the scene, back at the intersection, the van is abandoned. Billy Delgado is dying in the front seat, in the process of dying in the front seat, and over 500 rounds have been fired. People are running for their lives when they commandeer this, at gunpoint, this truck I just mentioned. And they first begin heading back to their home that they've, their compound, as you put it, their fortified home in Mira Loma, which is about 9 or 10 miles away, and they head up Hamner Avenue, which is the busiest boulevard in that area in Norco, and heads up towards Mira Loma. And as they head north, it starts to become more and more kind of rural. There's vineyards out there, there's bean fields, there's sheep grazing meadows and things like that, but it's still a very populated area. And as they begin to head towards their house, they're really weaving through side streets, and they turn almost every block. And so it's almost impossible for these pursuing units to predict where they're going to come out. The radio traffic, they're saying, okay, they're headed this way on this street. Then now they're headed this way on this street. Now they're headed this way on another street. And, trying to intercept them or set up a roadblock became almost impossible. There is not a helicopter on them at that point. Riverside County Sheriff did not have a helicopter. They had requested one from a nearby city, Riverside City PD, and that had not yet engaged the pursuit. So what was happening is these police officers were flooding into the area, and the California Highway Patrol had begun to self-dispatch off the freeways and were involved now, and but they would suddenly come upon this truck with almost no warning. And these, you have three guys firing high-powered rifles, and they were immediately being hit. with gunfire. There were numerous vehicles struck by gunfire, including civilian vehicles. They also rammed a few civilian vehicles. They pushed one out into an intersection, so they took that truck and just rammed them out of the intersection so they could get through the light. The next intersection, they rammed it, hit another car sideways. They T-boned it, sent it spinning, and then they started weaving through these streets. And in the matter of, about 10 minutes, there was an additional five people hit by gunfire, four deputies and a civilian. By the time they got up to Mira Loma, and then by the time the helicopter engaged them in Mira Loma, so when they did finally get to their house, they really had no ability to stop there. I mean, they had a helicopter on them, and they still had one California Highway Patrol unit and three deputies right following through these streets.
So, what was the route they took? What was the idea? Where were they? They originally had an idea to escape if the bank robbery were successful. Now, what was their idea and what was their route? And again, what was the advantage to this route?
Yeah, the initial idea was to, as you mentioned, they had parked a couple cold cars, which were their personal vehicles with stolen plates on them, and they were going to dump the van and the hostage, who's still in the back, they would dump the van, hop into those cars, head out to Las Vegas, and launder the money through the casinos there. By the time they got up to the cold cars, they had police officers. They were already encountering them. They'd been spotted. So Chris Harvin decided not to stop at the cold cars, and that's when they were headed towards their house. And the advantage, of course, was weaving through those streets was that nobody could get a bead on them or set up a roadblock or otherwise prepare to encounter them. They are at that point headed in the direction, inadvertently headed in the direction of a freeway. But the second destination was the house itself.
So tell us about what happens with the, again, it's interesting. You have all these deputies disabled, their cars disabled by gunfire, people piggybacking into other vehicles, people going first in the line, then dropping back. There is warning, too, to drop back from these guys because of their weaponry is hitting targets of a half a mile to a mile, which is astonishing. Again, there isn't communication with everyone. Tell us what happens with Deputy Jim Evans.
After weaving through the streets of a suburban Riverside County and deciding to abandon stopping at their house, they weaved around and they passed the house twice and then abandoned that idea, and then tried to actually commandeer another vehicle, which failed. But at that point, they had reached the freeway, the Pomona Freeway, and the strategy at that point was to head up into the mountains above Los Angeles and to then try to use the fact that they had this truck to lose the patrol vehicles, which are really sedans, and on the rough dirt roads, and eventually disappear into the canyons. So first thing they did is they got on the Pomona Freeway and then onto Interstate 15, and headed east into the mountains above Los Angeles, and and Riverside, San Bernardino, and they crossed into the San Bernardino County line. So they passed into the jurisdiction of the Riverside County Sheriff. So. And onto the freeway, which is the turf of the California Highway Patrol. So now you had Riverside still pursuing, California Highway Patrol descending from all different directions, and then the San Bernardino County Sheriff starting to flood onto the freeway at that point. And that's where they are hitting patrol vehicles from about a half a mile away. And soon the patrol units, the deputies and the CHP units, started to turn off their lights. Their light bars, because they realized they were being targeted. They could see the light bars. Chris Harvin also begins to slow down at points to try to ambush these pursuing vehicles, draw them in close, hit the brakes, and have those guys fire on them from close range. They throw out three fragmentation grenades on Interstate 15 that pepper the pursuing police officers with shrapnel. This whole time they're hitting civilian cars as well, semi-trucks, shooting them at close range, some inadvertently, some inexplicably turning their guns on civilians. So people are bailing off the freeway into the breakdown lane. Trucks are swerving to get out of the way. It is absolute chaos on this freeway. And it's at this point that they turn their guns on a San Bernardino County Sheriff's helicopter that's about 800 feet above them. And George Smith puts a round from a 308 right through the belly of this helicopter. And it immediately, the electrical system and the radios catches fire. And luckily, it's a Vietnam chopper pilot with tons of combat experience behind the stick in that helicopter, and he manages to get it down to the ground before it crashes. And they are then a second helicopter quickly comes in and resumes the pursuit. But the way they're headed is to the mountains of above Los Angeles, and they get off after about 8 miles. They get off at Sierra Road and start to head up Lytle Creek. And Lytle Creek is a place where they were familiar. It's a place where you can fire guns anywhere you want at that time. That's where they had gone to practice with their new weapons. They even threw a hand grenade down in the canyon to make sure they worked. That was a week before. So they're very familiar with this area. And if you know the San Gabriel National Forest and Mount Baldy in that area, these are very rugged mountains. They jut up to over 10,000 feet very rapidly. So these are very rough canyons. When that pursuit, and it's this is a two-lane road that starts as asphalt and then turns into a dirt road, and again, a rough dirt road. So a lot of these cars are breaking down. As you say, ones that were hit with gunfire are bailing out, and the police officers and some are jumping out of one vehicle and getting into another one. So they're now there's, some of them have two and even three officers in there. And you mentioned Jim Evans, and this is where on the I-15 is where Jim Evans, Riverside Deputy Jim Evans, joins the pursuit. I'll give you a little bit of background on Jim Evans. He's older. Yeah. He's about 38 years old. He's a career military. He is Green Beret, highly decorated in Vietnam combat missions. So he's a senior guy. He only joined the Sheriff's Department in about 5 years before, but he was certainly destined to move up the ranks. Just a wonderful human being, quiet. He's a Texan, so he's got that Texas drawl. Really looked up to by the by his fellow deputies, so Jim Evans is in one of the front cars in the pursuit as it heads up into this very ominous landscape of the mountains.
And you talk about Mary too. You describe and feature her in the story as well. She's a bus driver. It's later in the evening. I don't think she's heard. She hasn't heard any news at all. Tell us about that.
Yeah, Mary Evans. Jim and Mary Evans is really a unique kind of love story. Jim Evans was a Texan and military, and he moved to Riverside County because he was familiar with it from being there in the military. Mary was a Italian Roman Catholic from Boston who ended up in Riverside because she loved horses and had come out at one point. She had a pretty rough life, and she was a very tough woman. And when these two found each other, they had really found the love of their lives. They were a perfect couple together. They both loved to ride horses, owned horses, and it's kind of one of these things where at long last, both of them had found the perfect person, and they'd been married about 2 years and had a son that was about 8 weeks old at the time. And Mary was a municipal bus driver. And again, the times in which these things take place, if excuse me, if you didn't have the radio on, and even then you might not have even known this was going on unless you encountered this crazy pursuit that was unfolding. And she was on a bus route at the time, so she did not know her husband, Jim Evans, was involved in anything because she didn't know this was going on.
Yeah. Now, back to this pursuit here. We talk about it continues the next day because that's how dangerous this is, and they realize that with this ambush ability and darkness as a cover, that they should regroup, bring in another helicopter, and bring in some more people and hunt and kill team. Tell us about this endeavor the next day.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, you asked me, and I didn't wrap up the pursuit that day. As it goes up into Lytle Creek, there is a couple things that have occurred. Number one, there is a San Bernardino deputy named DJ McCarty, who happens to be sitting in the station getting off a shift, and he starts to hear the radio traffic through the squawk box there, and then he decides he's going to start to put his uniform back on and maybe get out there. And then another deputy, Jim McFerrin, is out in the field, and he hears the helicopter be grounded, and he radios back to the station. He says, "Get the AR." And what he meant was there was a M16, a military M16 rifle that they had confiscated from a drug dealer in a pursuit. Drug dealer had thrown it out mm-hmm. the window on the freeway. And that was the only high-powered rifle that either of those departments had, was this one confiscated M16 rifle. And the military didn't want it back, so it was sitting around in a sergeant's trunk of their car. And DJ McCarty runs out. He grabs that weapon, and this is a fully automatic M16, rifle that they use in Vietnam, and two four magazines full of ammunition. And he jumps in with McFerrin, and they start to try to make their way up to the front of the pursuit line. And they are radioing to other vehicles, get out of our way. We have a rifle here. And so they are starting to move up the pursuit line when this pursuit then goes on to a fire road, a very narrow fire road that is clean to the side of this mountain. And Jim Evans is then in the lead, and by then DJ McCarty has gotten to number two in the pursuit line behind Evans. But Evans, again, because of the radio situation, does not know that there is a vehicle behind him that has that high-powered rifle that they're trying to bring to bear on the pursuit. There are about 40 police cars still there, winding, still in the pursuit line as they head up this very treacherous fire road. And what happens is when they get around a curve, the truck encounters a washout in the road, and they have to bring the pursuit to a halt. Then they can't go any farther. They jump out and they ambush the pursuing police officers and deputies. And I won't give away that. That's a very dramatic scene. It is again another ferocious firefight. This time, 7,000 feet up a mountainside. And when it's over. Evans is dead, and the remaining four bank robbers disappear into the canyons of Mount Baldy. They run up the fire road, they climb over the washout, and they disappear in the canyons. By that time, it's coming on 5 o'clock in the evening. It's cold up there. The helicopter's a cloud cover descending, so they're going to lose their helicopter soon. It's starting to get dark, and the law enforcement decides they're just going to hunker down and start a massive manhunt the next day to round up these four escaped bank robbers and at this point cop killers.
This is it. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, I'm sorry. And this leads to your question about putting together this manhunt, which turns into the largest manhunt in California law enforcement history. And they start to bring in specialized teams. There's search dogs, sniffer dogs, and deputies on horseback. and search and rescue teams. They start to bring in helicopters. The military brings in Arctic parkas that some of the deputies put on. It gets very cold that night, and it does. There's a dusting of snow and freezing rain. And when they set off the next day, they have SWAT teams up there. They have these tracker teams. And what they brought in from Los Angeles County were what's known as the hunt and kill teams. And a hunt and kill team is two SWAT members, one with a shotgun and one with a high-powered rifle, and they are then accompanied by one deputy and one tracking team. And you can tell by the name that their job is, they're not officially called the hunt and kill team, but they're meant to to be able to locate suspects and, if necessary, have the firepower to, as they say, neutralize that suspect. So there are the hunt and kill teams up there as well when they start this massive manhunt the next day.
Yeah, interesting. The next day, you say it's incredibly cold, and these robbers, some of them awake. Russell awakes. George Smith awakes. He thought he might be dead because he had been hit significantly and was bleeding. Who do the hunt and kill teams, who do the police first encounter, and what does that person have to say once encountered? It's very interesting. Somebody is there to record.
Yes. Then, when they had escaped up the fire road, they had split up. The first to kind of go off the road and down the side of the mountainside to hide was George Smith. He had been shot in the groin back in front of the bank with a shotgun pellet, and had been twice, and had been bleeding out in the back of that truck. And he fully expected that he was going to die because he had lost so much blood. So he was weak. He went about 200 yards down the mountainside, kind of hid behind a bush, sat there through the night, and it was just a miserable night. They were soaked through with freezing rain. He'd thrown away his rifle at this point. He just had a couple of handguns on him, and George was kind of done. By the time, as you mentioned, he was waking up during the night and kind of looking up, and certain times thought he was actually dead. Kind of, am I alive? Am I dead? The first person law enforcement encounters is George Smith. And the other two, as I said, Chris Harvin, Russ Harvin, Manny Delgado, had all individually at some point gone over the side off the fire road and down into the mountains in the canyons, but they'd gone separately. So George, the next morning, George Smith is the first to be found, and he really gives himself up. But he's a few hundred yards down this very treacherous mountainside, and in his condition, it's going to take him a while to walk him down to where a helicopter can take him out. And San Bernardino sends a homicide detective up the mountainside with a tape recorder to interrogate George Smith as they're bringing him down. And it's very dramatic audio. You can hear the helicopter in the back, and Ross Dvorak, homicide detective Ross Dvorak, is interviewing George Smith. And first thing he tells him is, George, you realize you have a bullet in you. You realize you may die, right, George? And George says, yeah. And then, so basically what Ross Dvorak has got him into is sort of a deathbed confessional. And Ross Dvorak honestly thought he might die before he gets him down this mountainside. He can only go about 15 feet before they need to have him rest. He keeps saying he wants to go to sleep, but he gets a rather stunning confession and full accounting of the bank robbery and the names of the other bank robbers. And George admits that he'd put the whole thing together, his idea, as they're going down that mountainside. And in the end, George survives, and a lot of that is used against them all in the coming trial. So George is the first to give up at about 8:30 in the morning. Russ had found his brother Chris during the night. Chris had been shot in the back during the ambush up on the fire road. He had about had it midway through the through the night and went ahead and started a fire, just kind of, you know, the heck with it. If I get seen and caught, you know, I'm not getting out of this anyways. Russell sees the fire and goes down the hillside and meets up with his brother. And as it becomes light, and they just decide they're going to start walking out of the canyon. And if they walk out of the canyon, great. But they fully expected that they would be captured at some point down the way. So Chris has got the bullet in his back, and he is coughing up blood. Russell Harvin is diabetic, and he has no insulin or food on him. And he has also taken a shotgun pellet underneath his scalp in the intersection in front of the bank. It had not penetrated the skull, but it was still underneath his scalp. They are spotted and picked up. They had actually made it quite a ways out of Lytle Creek Canyon, but they were spotted and picked up and gave up about 10:30 in the morning. And that left
right.
Manny Delgado. Manny Delgado was the only one who had not been wounded during the firefight, but he had seen his 17-year-old little brother die in front of him, or badly wounded and clearly on his way to death. He was paralyzed at the time by the round, and the thinking was Manny was probably not going to give himself up at this point. His generally considered his state of mind, and he ran the farthest up the fire road, and then began during the night making his way over mountaintops, ridge lines and things like that. And when daylight came, he was kind of at the crest of a ridge line. Again, we're talking 7,000 feet up in the mountains, 8,000 feet I think is around where he was, under some very thick brush, so thick you'd have to crawl on your belly to really. To be able to penetrate it. And he is hunkered down there. Of course, he's got no food, whatever water he's just squeezing out of his clothes to drink. He is armed. He also has thrown away his rifle, and he's armed with a 38 revolver. The hunt and kill teams and the SWAT teams up there assume he has a high-powered rifle, but at that point he didn't. And Manny Delgado gets, just by almost sheer luck, gets spotted by a helicopter. When they see just a flash of blue from some gloves Manny was wearing for warmth that he'd used during the robbery. And they signal to a hunt and kill team, an L.A. County Sheriff's hunt and kill team, where he is. They hover down below him to cause such a racket. They're using the rotor blades to part the brush. Of course, it's a huge amount of noise and spraying dirt all over him and everything to kind of distract him while this hunt and kill team sneaks up. And when they get about 15 feet away, they yell for Manny to freeze. Manny looks over, kind of leans up, and these guys are not trained to give a fugitive, especially one who's already killed a police officer, any time. They don't give him any break,
yeah.
and they immediately, they open fire on him, and they kill Manny Delgado.
It's found out later that he killed himself.
Yeah, there's a bit of a mystery about the death of Manny Delgado. As I say, this hunt and kill team came up, one with a high-powered rifle, one with a shotgun. And when I said they didn't give him a break, they're not going to take any risk that fugitive is going to fire back at him. And when Manny Delgado hears them yell, he leans up. He's lying flat on his stomach at the time. He leans up kind of on his left, and they see he's got the gun in his hand. And they fire on him, but the autopsy later on shows that Manny Delgado was killed from a round from his own gun, shot straight through his heart. And there is kind of a poetry, if you will, about that. He'd just seen his little brother get killed, his little brother who he talked into becoming part of this, sure, he was brokenhearted, and there was some rumors that went around that maybe he had just killed himself, but it's more likely that he had fallen on the gun when the first round went through him and the gun then discharged. But it was the cause of death in the end, was a self-inflicted gunshot wound through the heart.
Yeah, he would have been dead one way or another. Right away, you have the fascinating aspect of that recorded confession from George Smith when he thought he was going to die, What's even more fascinating is when these characters are arrested and in prison, in jail, awaiting, and there's different responses now that there's the confession, but now that George realizes he's not going to die, and Chris has a different attitude with investigators once he's arrested. Tell us about those people being questioned. But first, tell us what both of their thoughts are, but especially George, once they are arrested, and concerning this whole revelation idea and end times.
Yeah, they the day they are captured, the three surviving bank robbers, they're of course split up, and we still have the interrogation tapes on all of them. Russell Harvin is he sounds utterly stunned to have found himself in this situation, and is just saying, "Boy, are my parents going to be surprised?" And needless to say, they were, and devastated. He also begins to just cough up information. You can hear he's reluctant to. He's trying to hedge it. He keeps saying he forgets things, but he does keep talking. Russ is a guy who's easily talked into things, and he was not much of a challenge for these interrogators. Plus, they'd been pretty much caught red-handed. Chris Harvin also gives out details. Chris is a little bit, it turns out more during the trial, a guy who's kind of in it to protect himself. But he tells about, he's also saying, I can't believe I got talked into this. It's such a stupid idea. I knew this was a stupid idea. I knew it wouldn't work. He says, George did this, and George gave peer pressure on me to do it. George is helicoptered to a hospital, and George just kind of freely talks. He's his usual very soft-spoken, intelligent self, he just says, I put it all together. I did this. I told these guys to do this. I told them where to go. I picked the bank and everything. So they all confess, and at that point, they don't really, neither of them mention anything about their beliefs, out of what propelled them to do it. It's only later when they go to trial that they begin to bring it up and almost use it as a strategy, rather than just it just being a greedy bank robbery. They kind of assign it a higher purpose, that they believe that the end of the world was coming. And that they were doing it because they needed to save those who they loved. So it was almost a higher purpose to it. One of the most unusual things is that 2 weeks after they are captured is when Mount St. Helens volcano blows up in Washington State. And both George and Chris see that, that catastrophic event. A lot of people die, but mostly just a natural phenomenon, natural disaster event. They think, well, here we go. George is thinking it's the first sign. Chris Harvin, the Jupiter effect isn't there at that time, but Chris had always thought it would be volcanic activity and seismic earthquakes and things along the Pacific Rim that would throw California into chaos and destruction. So it's kind of an unusual coincidence.
You talk about their attorneys, and of course there are people that are opposed to the death penalty because this is potential for a death penalty with this. What's interesting is who do they blame? They have to blame someone. So who do they blame in this?
Well, this trial was the most unexpected thing in this entire book and entire event. I grew up in Southern California. I knew when this event happened. It was absolutely astonishing to me. I mean, we've really seen nothing like it before. The trial, you get this whole new cast of characters come in, these very interesting and defense attorneys, and it's a death penalty trial. And it's not a matter of whether these guys are going to be found not guilty. It's whether they're going to be sentenced to death. But it is still a very dramatic trial, and it starts to go off the rails almost immediately with a jury selection that lasted 6 months, which is absolutely unheard of. And but this trial just becomes fascinating. Probably the most unusual development comes about 12 months into this trial, one of the more unusual, when Chris Harvin and his defense attorney to try suddenly throw a Hail Mary defense into this, in which they say that Chris was never even there for the bank robbery. In fact, Chris had tried to talk everybody out of doing this the morning of, and that there was a mysterious character named Jerry Cohen who was actually the guy mistaken for Chris Harvin in the bank, and it was Jerry Cohen who had forced them all to do this. And Chris had bailed out at the last second, so he claimed, and testifies to, and was running up Hamner Avenue to get back home when all of a sudden the yellow truck came, and Manny Delgado and Jerry Cohen pointed a gun at me and forced me to drive the truck, and I didn't want to do it, but that's why I'm up on the mountain, but I wasn't part of this. So this Jerry Cohen, who of course has never been found, is the one they blame, and the other is that they start to put the blame on Manny Delgado. Manny's not there to defend himself. Manny, by all accounts, was he and Russell Harvin probably the most prolific shooters in the entire pursuit. So they've been spotted. Manny had been sitting outside the cab for most of the pursuit, out the passenger window. And what was going to get them the death penalty was the death of Jim Evans, Deputy Jim Evans. And and so then there becomes another person who they start to blame on all this when it comes to the death of Jim Evans, and that is they put on a friendly fire defense, and they claim that D.J. McCarty, the San Bernardino deputy who had the M16 rifle that he had never used before in his life and did bring it to bear during that ambush and was in the vehicle right behind Jim Evans, so when they all jumped out of their vehicles, they say that D.J. McCarty opened fire with a gun he'd never used before and shot Jim Evans, who was 10 feet in front of him. And so D.J. McCarty not only has the traumatic experience of watching another deputy killed in front of him, the terror of almost being killed himself. I mean, he had been shot once, and he was taking heavy gunfire before he was able to figure out how to use this gun properly. Now he has the whispers and everything of other cops saying, well, they say that D.J. McCarty killed Jim Evans. So it was a really terrible experience all around for D.J. McCarty, who was a really young deputy at the time. So, the blame goes to this mysterious character, Jerry Cohn. Most of the time they're blaming Manny Delgado for being the one who's doing most of the shooting, and then they're just saying, no, that was Manny. No, that was Manny who was doing that. And the other is D.J. McCarty. So that was the basis of a lot of their defense.
Yes, it's also interesting when you talk about D.J. McCarty also, and the idea that Evans was shot, and that these perpetrators were all putting it on each other, and this mysterious Jerry Cohen. But part of the defense of George Smith, they, as per customary, they hire an investigator to assist the defense lawyer, especially in a capital case like this. Again, and just another fascinating twist to this story. We don't want to go too far into it, but what happens with this investigator named Painter?
Yeah, I won't go too far into it for obvious reasons. The most fascinating characters, if you will, I mean, I never lose sight that these are real human beings on both sides, but if you will, the characters are the defense team of George Smith. And that is an attorney, a real pit bull of an attorney, both in looks and in attitude, named Clayton Adams, who is fighting, to save George Smith's life. And he has assigned a investigator from the public defender's office named Jeannie Painter. And Jeannie Painter is 33 years old. She's a veteran investigator. She has done hundreds of felonies before. She's considered extremely good. also very carries heavy workloads, and investigators are, you know, needless to say, they're just absolutely critical to a trial. They're out there gathering evidence, they're out there interviewing people, they're orchestrating everything in the courtroom for the defense attorney. And Jeannie Painter is say 33 years old, and she's very attractive. There's a blonde hair and you know, a real head turner around the courthouse, which is mostly men in that era. As this trial moves ahead, and the trial was moved out of Riverside County down to San Diego County, there begins this relationship that develops between Jeannie Painter and George Wayne Smith. And a lot of it had to do with, you know, where Jeannie Painter was in her life, and she was still, as much of a veteran as she was still a young woman. She was now transferred away from her family and under incredible stress and incredible workload. And George Smith is a very compelling articulate guy, so this relationship, and that's a kind word for it, begins to develop between the two of them, and then soon turns into a lot of misconduct on the part of Jeannie Painter as she sort of falls under the spell of George Smith. And there's accusations of jailhouse sexual misconduct and smuggling drugs into the prison or into the jail. Bringing in naked photographs of herself for George, and so Jeannie Painter really takes a beating in this, really suffers under kind of a from this relationship that that she's developed with George Smith.
Yes, incredible.
And it threatens to derail this entire trial. I mean, in this trial is now months. I mean, in the end, it took 16 months, this trial, and between jury selection. And this was late in the game that this bombshell revelation comes out. And when the jail says Jeannie Painter is not allowed to visit George Smith in jail anymore, we won't have this going on. And it almost creates a mistrial in this at this late stage. But the judge is just desperate not to have this trial end after 12 months or 14 months, so he manages to keep Jeannie Painter involved and keep the trial moving.
It's one of the most fascinating parts of this book is the trial, like you say, but with Chris Harvin taking the stand and weaving this incredible story, fable, but it also hurts his fellow cohorts, doesn't it?
Yeah, it certainly does. In the process, I explain it a little bit, and I do describe why the mechanics of the legal system in trials kind of opens. Once Chris takes the stand and he begins to tell his own story, he then opens the door for evidence that had previously been excluded to now be included, including his statement, his confession or you know, statement to police. And as well as the other guys, which had actually been ruled out up to that point because it implicated the others. You can implicate yourself in a confession, but they were being tried together. All three of these, Russ, Chris, and George, were being tried together. And, the prosecutor, Jay Hanks, just completely tears apart Chris Harvin on the stand because it's a preposterous story. And Chris is trying to act like he's just this innocent victim and never shot a gun, tried to stop this from happening. And Chris has opened up the door, so Jay Hanks just dismantles him. And in the process, Chris implicates Russ. He effectively puts a gun in Russ's hands at the as well as George at the ambush site. During his testimony, because his confession, he had mentioned it, and so you know, these are guys are trying to blame it on Manny or on DJ McCarty, and you know some of them, George saying I was too weak, I couldn't even fire, others say I didn't even have a gun, Russ, Chris is saying I was shot in the back, and that's true enough, but so he didn't do it, but it was a very big deal when Chris Harvin for throwing this Hail Mary defense, this crazy defense, then ends up implicating, as they say, his best buddy, George Smith, and his little brother, putting a gun in their hand that might have gotten them the death penalty.
Yes, very interesting. Needless to say, what is the outcome? What do jurors decide? And what's the sentence?
Well, Yeah, they were found guilty on 46 major felonies, including kidnapping, explosives, 24 counts of attempted murder on a police officer. They were actually, you know, found guilty of the murder of Jim Evans as well as Billy Delgado under the felony murder rule because they started the firefight in which Billy Delgado got killed. So they had 46 major counts, and then it went into the penalty phase. And one of the more unusual things in the penalty phase is Clayton Adams had George Smith named a co-counsel in it, and it allowed George Smith to actually question some of his witnesses, or at least one of them, during the penalty phase. But it also allowed George Smith to give a closing argument, but only if George would refer to himself in the third person. And so that made it a kind of a creepy aspect to it, with George Smith staying up there. And this is the first time any of the jurors had heard George Smith. And what it did is allowed George Smith to kind of make a statement about himself without being cross-examined. So it's a bit of a legal trick. And it's quite a speech George gives, and it is overflowing with religious prophecy and scholarly interpretations of the Bible, which frankly lose a lot of the jurors along the way. But George is basically saying George Smith would never kill another human being. George Smith believes in the grace of the Lord Jesus Christ. George Smith would never do this. And it's a very odd moment. And in the end, they are sentenced to life without parole rather than the death penalty. And a reporter comments, who had covered the entire trial, comments that he thought it was sort of like Stockholm syndrome. You know, when you spend that amount of time in a room, as the jury had, in the same room with three human beings, no matter what they've done, you're just simply not going to be sentencing them to death. So they did get found. They were sentenced to life without parole, and that is where they remain today. Just a quick thing, Dan. I'm sure people have commented before, well, you're telling so much of the story. You know, why do you tell so much of the book? And I got to tell you, and I hope you'll agree, is there is so much detail that goes into these just fascinating details, and so much more that happened during that pursuit that I haven't mentioned, that no one has ever felt like I gave away the book by kind of telling what the major events are in it.
No, I think it just prompts somebody to want to read the entire thing, to catch everything, to grab everything and to understand everything that we've spoken about excitedly, both of us, because it's such a fascinating, exciting tale. The pursuit is incredible. These brave officers, the citizens running amok, the effect of this trial. So all of these things, and we hadn't even touched on just one little thing that, again, it was interesting about George Smith's father being dismissed from or quitting the police force after he encountered resistance when he was being an honest cop and found corruption. And again, just another little thing that added to George Smith's it seemed in conflict with his character that George Smith would end up where he did end up. So it's very, very fascinating how the background and everything that you brought into this story factors into this incredible tale.
Well, you know, one of the elements of the 70s, of course, was this what ranged from distrust or adversarial kind of attitude towards police officers. You know, some people hated them, you know, thought them the foot soldiers of the status quo. And George and Chris certainly didn't hate them, but they didn't trust them. And George had that that experience in his family where his father was at Casper, Wyoming, and arrested two police officers who he caught in the middle of the night robbing a store on Main Street. And when he brought him back to the department, he's the one who got a you know, they let him go and said, "What the hell are you doing, arresting these guys?" And he found really kind of deep corruption, and it was very disillusioning. His father had always wanted to be a cop, so that was kind of circulating in the family, this idea that you can't trust policemen. which made George and Chris even want to arm up more, because they felt their attitude was, well, cops kill people if they find them. You know, if they catch us, they're going to try to kill us. So, you know, they didn't set out to kill any cops, but they certainly certainly tried once they had these once the firefight began.
Yes. I want to thank you very much, Peter, for coming on and talking about Norco 80, the true story of the most spectacular bank robbery in American history. It's been actually an absolute privilege and a thrill for me to talk to you and share this book with other people, the listener. For those people that might want to look at this, is there a website or Facebook page quickly that you could refer us to?
Yeah, certainly. And thank you, Dan. I really appreciate it. My website is peterhulahan.com, H-O-U-L-A-H-A-N. But really, the book is available everywhere. There's an audio book that's out now as well, was released at the same time. So all the places you normally buy books, you can find this one. So it's out there in the world and available.
Thank you very much, Peter Houlihan. Good night.
Thanks, Dan.
Good night.